Louis Vincent Gauve, founding partner and CEO of GauveCal. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks a bunch for having me.
Louis, it's a real honor to get to speak with you. I've been looking forward to this interview for a while here. And the reason is because I try to get a perspective of the world through actually traveling and experiencing it. I feel like what I've learned about you through listening to podcasts and things like that is that you're very much the same. And you have, let's say, a specific information set from the East. And I think that's excellent because trying to get a more accurate view of the world seems to be difficult if you only, let's say, read X or read the news, anything like that. So specifically speaking about your, let's say, experience in China and trying to understand the delta between what is published and the reality on the ground, especially from an investor's perspective, is really important. So why don't we start with trying to understand what you think are the biggest misconceptions with China, and is it the new reflationary force in the world?
Well, first, again, thanks a bunch for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I think that's a pretty broad question. We could spend all day, let alone an hour, and barely even scratch the surface. I think there's no doubt. I'll start with the end of your question, the reflationary impact of China. I think there's no doubt that in the past 7 or 8 years, China has been a massive deflationary weight for the world. And the reason China was such a deflationary weight for the world was that the focus of policy in China was first and foremost to de-Westernize its supply chains. This was the focus because the leadership felt that being dependent on the West was a problem for national security reasons. Essentially, when the U.S. weaponized its semiconductor supply chain against China, China started to worry that the U.S. could do this for all sorts of industries, not just semiconductors. It could do this for auto parts and chemical products and turbines and whatever else. And that therefore China had no choice but to produce everything by itself. This meant that for the past 7 or 8 years, China mobilized all of its savings, and China's savings are enormous. So China mobilized all of its savings to this single purpose, de-Westernize its supply chain. And as the policy and leadership did this, it created a twin deflationary impact for the world. The first deflationary impact is that it triggered a real estate bust in China. When the government told the banks, guys, don't lend to real estate anymore, real estate prices went down by a third, commodity prices went down, construction companies went bust, people tightened their belt, there was less consumption, et cetera. So that was the first deflationary impact on the world. The second is that as all this money went into industry, you saw China all of a sudden start to export cars, start to export nuclear power plants, start to export tractors and earth moving equipment, and you name it. And China essentially went from being a low value added, low-end manufacturer of pretty cheap goods, think plastic toys that you buy at Walmart or textiles or shoes or whatever else, to all of a sudden producing high-end, high-value-added goods like cars and tractors. Mm-hmm. And so as China went through this transition, essentially Chinese demand was reduced and Chinese supply exploded. So that was massively deflationary for everybody. And this allowed countries like the United States, like Europe, like Japan and others, to follow a policy settings that were much looser than otherwise would have been. So much looser fiscal policy, much looser monetary policy. The US could budget deficit right now 6.5% of GDP. In the past, if you thought, okay, we've got 4% unemployment rate, give or take, we have 6.5% budget deficit, you would think that the economy would start running really hot and really, have a lot of inflation. This didn't happen because China was this deflationary weight on the world. Now, this is where things are changing, is that in 2017, 2018, China was really worried that the US was coming after it and that it wasn't ready for a proper trade war. Fast forward to today, and the Chinese leadership, you might think they're wrong, but the Chinese leadership feels much more comfortable about where they are now. They look at their own exports, they look at their own competitive position in pretty much every key industry, and they feel, you know what, the US can't really come after us anymore. Even at the very pinnacle of technology, i.e., in AI, we are competitive, with Qwen, with DeepSeek. So the semiconductor restrictions the US imposed didn't prevent us from developing AI. And so the Chinese leadership now feels okay, we're essentially, we've won the trade war. We've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish, which was to de-Westernize our supply chains. And so now we can start to give a little more to the consumer. So now you start to see the renminbi, which is just so stupidly undervalued, you start to see the renminbi coming up, which is a massively reflationary force for the world. A weak renminbi is very deflationary for everybody. A strong renminbi is reflationary. So you're starting to see the renminbi coming up. You're starting to see Chinese equity prices outperform most other markets out there. So you're starting to see an important policy shift in China, which in turn should lead Western policymakers to say, okay, if China isn't going to be this deflationary black hole, can we keep having very easy fiscal and very easy monetary policy? So far, this discussion hasn't happened. And so bond markets are adjusting, and you're seeing bond yields creep up every day. At some point, I think the bond markets will force the conversation onto the policymakers.
You know, this is such a, let's say, a complex situation and country to understand from trade perspectives, from, internal within China. I saw a recent tweet about the, let's say, the real estate of China, 60 to 70% of homeowners being more than 15% underwater on the purchase price of their homes, wage growth being stagnant, college graduates not having proper jobs in their fields, doing food delivery instead. And private sector and government employees alike going unpaid because of a lack of cash. Do you think that that is, let's say, inaccurate or just a shift because of the changing nature of China going from this deflationary force, as you mentioned, to a reflationary force?
So I think those are all separate issues. Look, China's a very, very big place. So you can, just like the United States, you can always find examples of anything you want. And the same is very much true for China. It's such a massive economy now. Now, the problems you highlighted are somewhat interlinked, but not fully. So starting off with local government employees going unpaid, most of the local governments essentially fund themselves through land sales. And so when you have a real estate bust and all the property companies go bust, then you don't have any land sales. And if you don't have land sales, the local governments are squeezed and can't pay their workers. So that was one very clear problem, which the government essentially, the central government, because in China, you talk about the government, but there's local governments, there's municipalities, provincial governments, and central governments, a little bit like the United States. So the analogy would be, imagine if there was a massive real estate bust in California and tax receipts collapsed and California government couldn't make payroll and the municipal governments couldn't make payroll. Essentially what happened, and this happened last summer, the central government stepped in and bailed out a lot of the local authorities, moved a lot of the local authority debt onto the central government balance sheet and recapitalized a lot of the local authorities so that wages of local employees actually did get paid. So there was some tensions, and that's a story that was really the summer of the summer of 2024, so more like 18 months ago. And all that got done. So that was one problem. The problem of negative equity is definitely a problem. You look at most major cities in China, and real estate prices are probably down anywhere from 25 to 35%. And so a lot of people are indeed nursing losses of 10, 15% on the real estate that they bought. I don't know if it's, I think you said 60%. That seems high to me, because I don't think everybody, I don't think 60% of people bought in the sort of 2 or 3 years before it rolled over. So that seems unduly high, but you know, I don't know what the exact number is. The reality is prices are down 25 to 35%, which is one of the probably most important factors contributing today to the very poor consumer confidence. I think if you look at China today, you have an economy where that benefits from the cheapest cost of electricity in the world, the cheapest cost of labor when you adjust it for productivity, the cheapest cost of capital, and by far the cheapest currency. So on paper, this economy should be absolutely booming when you have cheap cost of capital, cheap cost of electricity, cheap cost of labor, cheap cost of currency. The place should be going bananas. It is not. It is not because confidence is being shred to pieces. And it's been shred to pieces very much by the trade war and the Chinese policy response to the trade war, i.e., the mobilizing of all the resources that I mentioned earlier, away from real estate, away from the stock markets, away from consumption, and into this singular goal of de-Westernizing supply chains, which was seen as a national strategic imperative. Now, this absolutely crushed business confidence and it crushed consumer confidence. And so today, the main problem in China is first and foremost a problem of confidence. And then if you're the government, you think, okay, how do I solve this? And there's, you know, different ways you can go about it. But it's almost like Roosevelt's old quip that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. China's problem today is one of confidence. And the reason people have shredded confidence is very mostly the reason. There's a lot of reasons. I think the government's response to COVID was one of them. But the single most important reason is the one you highlighted. People are negative equity on their real estate, and that's a real drag. So that's a second problem. The third problem, the youth unemployment problem, is a real problem, and of course it feeds into this poor confidence, etc. But the youth unemployment problem is somewhat different, and it's linked to the fact that if you go back to a generation ago, so I studied Chinese at Nanjing University in the early 90s, and back then China was graduating roughly 350 to 400,000 university students a year. China is now graduating 12 million university students a year. So you've had an improvement in human capital in one generation that is simply unprecedented. And the one of the problems is that out of those 12 million kids leaving university every year, almost all of them want to get jobs in the service industry. They want to get jobs with a phone and a computer and go into an office. They don't want jobs in a factory and they don't want jobs on a construction site. And it's not one of the problems. It's not like China has 12 million insurance brokers or bankers or et cetera that are retiring every year. And so you've had such a dramatic improvement in such a short period of time in human capital, and the jobs on the other side haven't followed. And I think for the government, the challenge is that while you were moving for 50 years, China's growth story was essentially moving farmers from the countryside into the cities. And what you did was you took farmers that produced 500 goods worth 500 or 1,000 bucks a year, and you transformed them into factory workers that were producing goods worth 15,000 bucks a year. And that act alone was a huge productivity gain. And it's not very hard to transform a farmer into a factory worker or into a construction worker. It's, you know, that can be done decently easily. The challenge now, and if you're the government, you can look at a map and say, okay, let's build a port here and we'll need so many workers, and let's build a dam over there, and let's build a highway here. And governments are pretty good at this. You know, building out infrastructure is one of the things that government should be pretty decent at. And the Chinese government is actually very good at this because it's run by engineers. So they actually love doing that. They love saying, "Oh, let's build a road here and an electric dam here." They're like, they cherish this at the top of the Chinese government. But it's not like the government can take out a map and say, "You know what? Let's build an insurance business here and a sports marketing business over there." And so this can only come organically, right? It can only come organically if, and it should come if you offer people cheap electricity, cheap labor, cheap cost of capital. It should come, but it doesn't come overnight. And so the challenge today for China, I think, is the youth unemployment is a real problem, and I think it gets solved once confidence improves. That's the challenge for the Chinese government, is can they, get people's animal spirits flowing again? I think they're trying their best to do that. They're trying their best to do that, and one of the methods they're using to do that is cranking up the stock market. Is we crank up the stock market as a signal that things are going well to people, which should encourage them to take on more risk. And I think that's why, since they intervened in the market in January 2024, the Chinese stock market has outperformed most others.
Yeah, and to your point, I saw a recent chart that I think they had the highest daily volume ever, quite recently, right? In the Chinese stock market.
Yeah, no, volumes are definitely picking up. And it's now, in fairness, the Chinese stock market keeps growing because you keep getting, unlike the US, where a lot of companies go private and a lot of companies do share buybacks, i.e. Microsoft and Apple, et cetera, keep buying back shares. So actually the outstanding volumes of shares keeps shrinking in the United States. In China, it tends to expand because you do get IPOs, you do get rights issues, you do get a lot of companies that, so they logically, you're absolutely right that volumes are at all-time highs, but I think they'll, every year will continue to be all-time highs in China.
Well, yeah, it definitely seems like that shift has a dramatic impact on, something that didn't necessarily have a whole lot of, let's say, interest or ability to trade versus opening that up, right? But Louis, you mentioned the idea of consumer confidence. And of course, in the West, we think about when people don't feel confident in the markets, in their currency, especially, they kind of end up moving to precious metals, gold and silver. What do you think is the, let's say, the attitude from the everyday person in towards precious metals? And is it materially different from the way that the government actually sees the role of gold and silver within the economy?
Okay, so that's a great question. So first, to your point, I don't think things are different in Asia. I would say they're even more so. And by the way, it's not just China, it's all over Asia. Now, when you look at the roaring bull market we've had on precious metals in the past few years, and especially I would say since essentially the Western world seized Russian assets following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because that's when I think that this latest leg of the bull market in gold really, really started, or silver, really, really started. I think when you look at a bull market, you got to look at it through four prisms. First, you start with the fundamentals, i.e., does this rise make sense? And I think when you look at the precious metal bull markets, it does make sense. When you look at fiscal policies around the world, when you look at monetary policies around the world, when you look at the rise in geopolitical tensions, et cetera, there's lots of reasons you would think that gold would go up. But primarily, the reality remains that foreign central banks have been buying roughly 25% of global production for the past 3 years since Russia invaded Ukraine, since the seizure of Russian assets. A lot of countries have started to feel, well, do I want to keep my money in US treasuries? Do I want to keep my savings in German bonds? Maybe I'm just safer owning gold bars in my own safe. And so countries like Saudi Arabia, like Poland, like China, like Thailand, have all started to be big gold buyers on the market. Now, that's been a new marginal buyer. The other big marginal buyer have been Asian investors, much more so than Western investors. And when I say Asian investors, I really mean Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. Indian have been buyers, but they're always buyers. So at the margin, I don't think that's changed that much. So that brings me to the, so I look at a bull market on four prisms: fundamentals. Then I look at the momentum. There's no doubt that the momentum on precious metals has been strong. And then I look at the investor positioning. And here that brings me to your question on what Chinese and Asian investors are doing. Now, one of my long-term core beliefs is that precious metals, a lot of people look at precious metals like a hedge against inflation. For me, really, precious metals are a hedge against inappropriately low interest rates. I think it's when interest rates are essentially at zero at the bank that your retail investor will say, you know what, why am I keeping all this money at the bank and earning zero? Screw it. I'm going to move and buy precious metals. And this is why I think if you look at the past 2, 3 years, the big buyers of gold have not been in Europe. They've not been in the United States. They've been in Japan, they've been in China, and they've been in South Korea. And you see this through the import data. You see this through shares outstanding of gold ETF. So if you look at the Japanese gold ETF, you look at the Chinese gold ETF, their shares outstanding have gone parabolic. You look at the shares outstanding in GLD, shares outstanding in SLV, shares outstanding in SGLD, LN, which is the biggest ETF in Europe, gold ETF in Europe. Look at the shares outstanding in GDX. It's actually fascinating. GDX is for your listeners who don't know, is the biggest gold miner ETF. Now, the gold miners have gone 150% in the past 12 months. And the shares outstanding in GDX are almost at a 10-year low. So Westerners have been fading this whole time. So it's actually so all this to say that to your question and to your point, if you're Chinese and you are sitting on a lot of savings, and the bank is offering you essentially 0%, and your real estate, which was for years and years your default allocation for Chinese people, they bought real estate, and now real estate's been going down and continues to feel very top heavy. And then stocks are always volatile. And then you think, okay, maybe I'll buy some gold, and gold goes parabolic as a result. Because if Chinese and Japanese investors that tend to be, and throw in Korea as well, tend to be the biggest marginal savers in the world today. It's not like Europeans are saving much money. It's not like Americans are saving much money. The savings is occurring really in Asia. And if that money is going into gold, that's how you end up with the moves that we've seen.
Well, trying to step back and understand these shifts and let's say position accordingly to try and get ahead and be able to capitalize on some of these shifts is, always what we're thinking about as investors. So stepping back and kind of going back into the idea of the renminbi, from a currency perspective, does this also present one of these massive opportunities as, the renminbi is being very mispriced, despite China needing to have a cheap currency to still facilitate exports as well as keep stimulating their economy with debt? Or is that the old way of thinking, and that is the shift that we need to be paying attention to?
Yeah, I don't think they need a cheap currency to stimulate their exports anymore. I think they needed it during the trade war. As you build out your industrial capacity, you want to shelter your industrial base so that it can build out. But it has now been built out. It's now super competitive. One of my favorite data points, which is, I think, a pretty fair comparison, you look at the Tesla plant in Fremont, California versus the Tesla plant in Shanghai. And the reason it's a fair comparison is they produce the same cars. And the Tesla worker in California cost $85,000. The factory line worker costs $85,000 plus an extra $22,000, I believe it is, in medical costs. That same worker in Shanghai costs $14,000 and no medical costs. So the medical cost of the California worker is more than the salary of the Chinese worker, and the Chinese worker produces almost twice as many cars per worker as the California worker. So the productivity is, so all this to say that if the renminbi goes up 10, 15%, is that going to hurt the productivity of the Chinese worker? Not really. He's already so competitive No, so far it's so far mispriced that a small move isn't going to change all that much. Which brings me to my second point, is that I think when it comes to the currency, the renminbi is an opportunity today because it's moving up, but we should not expect any massive one-time moves. It's going to be very slow. The way China's always done FX policy, foreign exchange policy, is they like to say that we feel the stones as we cross the river, which I think is good imagery. You know, as you cross the river, you're not running across. You're taking it very slowly. And this is what China's doing. So you have small gradual revaluation, small gradual devaluation. But the reason it matters economically, and which provides then the opportunity, is the signal that this sends to the Chinese savers themselves. When the perception is, oh, the renminbi is going down, if you're a Chinese person, you think, well, if the renminbi is going down, I may as well put my savings abroad. I may as well buy Microsoft. I may as well buy Mag 7. I may as well buy gold. However I can do it, I put my money abroad. And on the flip side, if the perception is the renminbi is now going up, if I'm a rich Chinese saver, I think, okay, it's now time to bring my money home. Because even if it's, you know, even if the renminbi is only going up 5 or 6% a year, if I can buy high dividend yielding stocks like PetroChina, like Xinjiang Mining or others that give me six, or China Mobile or whoever, that can give me 6, 7% a year, and the renminbi itself is going to go up 6% a year. Now, all of a sudden, I'm looking at a 12, 13% returns in US dollars, which, you know, is better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick, especially if at the same time your real estate market isn't doing very much. So the reason, and to answer your question, when you look at the renminbi going up, which it is, the question is, okay, great, let's buy the renminbi. And that's fine. It's not a bad trade per se, but you're not going to make 20 or 30% on that. You're going to make 5, 6, 7%, and that's fine. But if at the same time, I think when the renminbi starts to go up, then that means that a lot of Chinese assets, most notably all the high dividend yielding stocks, that's where you're going to make the 20, the 30%.
Again, trying to understand and position from a shifting global economy and global order in some ways, you have been outlining a growth synergy or a growing synergy, and especially an effort to rebuild the relationship between China and India as a longer macro shift that you're trying to get positioned for. What do you think are the key points to understand about, let's say, why and the outcomes of the rebuilding of this relationship?
So this is, I think, far more speculative. You know, sometimes you have ideas and you feel very strongly about them. And so far, everything I've described, I feel pretty strongly about, and I have a very high level of conviction. The repairing of the China India relationship, I think, is far more speculative. So what I'm about to say next may very well not happen. And there's lots of reasons they may not happen. But look, when I look at foreign relations, and by the way, part of that is because now we're talking about diplomacy, we're talking about geopolitics, where A, there's many outliers, there's many possible changes. And so your level of certainty just can't be as high. So with that disclaimer aside, when I look at geopolitics, I start off with Lord Palmerston's old dictum that, nations have no permanent friends and no permanent enemies, just permanent interests. And I think that when you look at the overall Asian continent, there's three landmass powers. There's Russia, there's China, there's India. Now, Russia's business model and permanent interest for 200 plus years was to get stuff out of the ground and sell it to Europe. That was the business model of Russia. If you're Russia today, that business model no longer works for fairly obvious reasons, namely the Russia-Ukraine war and the fact that Europe is now very anti-Russia as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So If you're Russia, you're looking at your business model and you say, okay, so my business model is now getting stuff out of the ground and selling it to China. Now, if you're Russia, that's actually deeply unsatisfying. You probably know the old joke that if you only have one client, you don't have a client, you have a boss. And so if you're Russia, having just China as a client is no good. You have to diversify further. I think if you're India, your permanent interest has always meant to be to get cheaper commodities. You have the most populous country in the world. You're a big commodity importer of many different commodities. And today, if you are going to get your economy to keep growing, you need to do proper infrastructure spending. Build roads, airports, telecom systems, ports, power plants, you name it, India needs it. And all that, A, requires a lot of money, requires a lot of capital, and requires a lot of commodities. Now, the problem for India is that India's business model, when you think of, okay, how's India going to fund all of this spending? When you look at India's big export industries, it's been essentially lately in the past 10, 20 years, it's been IT services that are deeply, deeply threatened by everything that's happening in AI. All the sort of outsourcing of coding work, et cetera, you can do much faster now with AI. So that's your first big challenge if you're India. Again, think back permanent interest. That's your first problem. Your second big industry was call centers. And that's also deeply threatened by everything that's happening in technology. So you're Modi and you're looking at my two biggest, essentially, foreign currency earners. Those are threatened. And so that's my first problem. The other way I earn currency, to be honest, is I send trained and smart people around the world, whether it be Australia, Canada, United States, Europe, lots of very qualified Indian workforce, whether to work in the medical professions, the accountants, the software guys, etc. And these guys all send money home. Now, that part is also threatened because everywhere around the Western world, there is a backlash against immigration. And if you're Modi, you just have to acknowledge this, that Canada, the US, etc., may not take in as many Indians as they've done in the past. So now you're Modi and you're thinking, okay, all my main revenue sources to earn dollars are drying up fast. And at the same time, here comes Russia saying, hey, I'll sell you commodities in rupees. So it's like, oh, okay, well, this is interesting to me. Because if I can buy the commodities in rupees, that solves my permanent interest problem. That solves my biggest challenge. But Russia then says, but I don't want to have to ship them through water because then the US can block them. And the US has made it pretty clear that they're considering doing that. So really what you have to do is you have to get along with China so that China builds the infrastructure to ship the commodities from Russia through China into India. And that only works if the three of us decide that we get along very well. And this is where how you get to Tianjin on this late August, early September, the meeting between the three of them where they walk out on the stage and they're hugging it out and they're making out as they're like best of friends. Now, I think, whenever I talk about this, people always tell me, ah, oh, this will never work. Russia and India, China hates Russia and Indians hate China. And you have all the border issues between all these countries, so on and so forth. And I understand all the historical reasons why this may not happen. But I'm French. We fought over 100 years. We fought three very devastating wars against Germany. And then we decided actually it's in our national interest for us to get along. And then we did. And we managed to put the past behind us. And our past between France and Germany was much bloodier than the past between Russia and India, between Russia and China. And I know there's border disputes, and I know there's been a war between them in the 60s, but that's nowhere near as bad as we had it between the Germans and the French. So I highlight all this because if, and this is a massive if, I don't know if it's going to happen, But if Modi, Xi, and Putin are serious about building the infrastructure so that they can trade more with each other, so that essentially you can move the world's cheapest commodities, i.e., Russia commodities, marry it with the cheapest cost of capital and the cheapest cost of machine tools to India's cheapest cost of labor, and you put all of this together, then you have the recipe for a boom of epic proportions. And what's fascinating to me is I simply don't believe that financial markets today are priced in for this at all. Because whenever I talk about it, people are telling me it's not going to happen. They all hate each other, et cetera. And then I say, well, look, these guys are telling you, Modi, Xi, and Putin are telling you it is going to happen. So either they're lying to you, or it is going to happen. Now, it could be that they're lying to us, but why? Why would they lie to us about this? And when it's very clearly in all of their national interests for this to happen. So, and perhaps I'm too delusional, and I've spent the past almost 30 years in China now, where the Chinese policymakers do have a decent track record of saying what they do and doing what they say. So when they turn around, when they hug it out on stage in Tianjin, as they did on September 1st, and they say, this is the path we're going, I think it's at least worth exploring as an idea.
Well, and I think from a macro force perspective, there's nothing as powerful as moving a massive population out of poverty, right?
Yes.
Bringing, we have seen that with China over the past 2 decades, and India is the very likely the next to at least attempt to try to do the same, right?
Yes. And now the challenge, there's a lot of challenges for India that weren't China. There's a lot of advantages for India that weren't China, that weren't China's. So you can learn from the Chinese experience and then look at India and say, okay, this matches, this doesn't match, this can be replicated, this can't. And we try to do a lot of that in our work, to be honest. The India story will end up being very, very different. It'll end up being exciting in its own right. I think what China has accomplished in essentially taking 800 million, if you go back to the late 80s, China was much poorer than India. China's taken 800 million people out of abject poverty. There were people starving in China as late as the early 70s. So China's what you've witnessed in China is taking 800 million people out of abject poverty into now a middle class lifestyle that, frankly, a lot of the world, if they came to see and visit, would actually envy, with very decent healthcare, free education, and public transportation that's world class. It really is a sight to behold, what has been accomplished in 40 or 50 years. And I know that in the West, it's common to denigrate this and to say, oh, communism is bad, and oh, totalitarian system, etc. And of course, no country is devoid of criticism. But we also have to acknowledge that a lot was accomplished in 3 or 4 decades. And that, from 20 years ago, when the life expectancy of China was 20 years below that of the United States, China now has a life expectancy that is above that of the United States, which is, to me, that's mind-blowing. And it should be a wake-up call to everybody to say, okay, how, and every I'm surprised that people aren't more curious as to how this was achieved, more open-minded about, okay, what is happening over there that perhaps we can learn something from.
You have something that you call the Gavikal asset allocation grid. What quadrant are we currently in, and what benefits in these times?
So the grid you're referring to is something that my dad published back in the mid-70s. And it's a very simple idea that asset prices are determined by the interaction of economic activity and inflation. So periods when inflation accelerates and growth accelerates are called inflationary booms. Period when inflation accelerates but growth decelerates are called inflationary busts. When both decelerate, it's a deflationary bust. And when inflation decelerates and growth accelerates, it's a deflationary boom. Now, the natural state of capitalism is the deflationary boom. The natural state of capitalism is the deflationary boom because most entrepreneurs, most CEOs wake up every morning thinking, how do I produce more with less? How do I produce more with fewer workers or fewer, less energy or fewer, less copper or whatever, depending on what you produce. Everybody's always trying to do more with less. And so to the extent that capitalism works, and it does work, the natural state of capitalism is a deflationary boom. At the same time, the natural state of democracies, I think, is the inflationary boom, because most politicians will spend their whole day thinking, how can I promise more to voters without having to pay for it? And I would leaning on the central banks to pay for this. And so the natural state of affairs is to oscillate between inflationary booms and deflationary booms, and a competent, well-managed central bank will keep you in the deflationary boom, which benefits the greatest number of people, and an incompetent central bank will push the system into an inflationary boom and eventually into an inflationary bust. Now, when I look at the world today, what I find is policies everywhere around the world that are essentially pushing the system into an inflationary boom. Think about the budget deficits that are growing in the United States, in Europe, in Japan, in China. We just mentioned how China had moved from being a deflationary force to a reflationary force. And as everybody is essentially stepping on the fiscal gas, what you also have is central banks that are pretty much everywhere talking about cutting interest rates rather than rising them. In Japan, they should have risen them and they never did. In Europe, they're cutting. In the United States, they're cutting. They're doing this at a time when asset prices are pretty much at all-time highs, when unemployment rates are at all-time lows. So everything is pointing to us being very much in an inflationary boom on the policy side, but also on the market side. The markets are confirming this. You have metal prices breaking up. In fact, commodity indices broadly breaking out to the upside. You have steepening of yield curves. You have, up until very recently, financials outperforming almost everywhere, but cyclical sectors outperforming pretty much everywhere. So the markets are telling you you're in an inflationary boom. The policy making is telling you you're in an inflationary boom. So I think you can conclude that today you are in an inflationary boom. And in an inflationary boom, the last thing you want to own is bonds. It's almost, if you think of your four quadrant, when you think, okay, I'm up on the top right, then what I don't want to own are the assets that do well on the bottom left, because these are the assets that this is the risk factor that's the less in the system. So I don't need to hedge against that scenario. And that brings us back to something my dad always likes to say, that managing money very often, it's not as much about picking winners as about avoiding losers. So you try to build yourself a portfolio, not with the assets that you think are going to hit it out of the park, but with the assets that essentially don't stand a chance. And today, for the past 5 years, bonds have been a terrible asset class to own. Anybody who has owned bonds, anybody who's been advocating long bonds, has been taken to the cleaners. And there are few reasons to think that much has changed on that front. Nothing has changed on the policy front to say, okay, now it's time to advocate for bonds. Nothing has changed on the regulation front. Nothing has changed. So bonds have been a dog with fleas, and they remain dog with fleas.
So does that, let's say that quality of bonds, does that really only apply to, let's just call it Western bonds, or does that also apply to, Chinese and Eastern type bonds?
No, I think it applies mostly to OECD government bonds. And the reason for that is I think in Eastern bonds, perhaps even including JGBs now, what you have is a pretty clear desire by local policymakers to drive up their currencies. Well, for the past 3, 4 years, they were driving down their currencies. So owning bonds and strengthening currencies is actually work. So if you look at the past 5 years, one of the best performing bond markets in the world has been the Swiss bond market. And which is fascinating because 5 years ago, Swiss bond yields were at zero and they're still at zero. But the Swiss franc has been very strong over the same period. So you made money thanks to the currency. Now, the renminbi is starting to go up. I think the yen is starting to go up. The Korean won is starting to go up. Now, all these bond yields are very low. But if you're going to make money on the currency, that makes up for it. So I think there is a case very much for Asian bonds as a currency play. Meanwhile, my favorite bond market, and I've argued this for the past 18 months on several podcasts, and has been the Latin American debt market, because you're starting there from a very, very different place. You're starting there from a place of much, much, much higher real rates to begin with. But you're also starting from a place where in Latin America, you have policymakers that, unlike our policymakers, have actually been inflation hawks. And I think the reason for that, it's the old saying that you don't make your father's mistakes, you make your grandfather's mistakes. So most of the policymakers in Latin America know inflation. They know it in their bones. You get to be a policymaker, central banker or a finance minister in your 50s or your 60s. And so these guys, in their bones, they know of the inflation that they endured in the 80s and the 90s. They lived it. They know that when you get inflation, it's like falling pregnant. First, you're a little pregnant, then you're very pregnant, and then you have a problem for 18 years. That's what inflation is like. And they know it. So they're not taking the risk. They're not taking the risk of falling pregnant. They're using the pill and condoms. They're being double safe. And so you can own bonds in those countries, as opposed to us, which where we think we're never going to fall pregnant, and we're going to end up with triplets.
Where they're going to solve every problem in the world.
That's right. That's right.
So, Louis, kind of trying to again get this broader perspective, does this make commodities and, especially metals a very important part of the investing landscape to understand and continue to be invested in based on, those factors that you mentioned earlier about momentum, interest, and just overall market participation?
So I think I'll start with commodities and then I'll drill to metals. But when I look at commodities, the answer is yes, by the way, to your question. I could say that and just shut up, but I'll give a little more. So the answer is yes, you do need exposure to commodities today. The fundamental story on commodities is a compelling one. I think there's been underinvestment in exploration, underinvestment in production, in a growing world where most of the marginal demand is increasingly going to come from emerging markets, where growth is extremely commodity intensive, much more so than in our service-based economies. When you look at it, we were mentioning India, but when you look at India's infrastructure spending needs, it's going to take iron ore, it's going to take copper, it's going to take nickel, it's going to take all these sorts of things that we're really not producing enough of already as it is today, let alone 5 years' time and 10 years' time. When you look at a place like Africa essentially is moving from a population of 400 million to 1.5 billion over, from essentially 1990 to 2035. And as a result, Africa, which has always been a huge commodity exporter of everything, at some point in the next 10 years, commodity after commodity, Africa stops exporting and just starts consuming at home what they need. So it's put it all into perspective, and you think, okay, the growth of demand is going to be there. The supply, I think, the supply is actually, and I'm not saying that I'm not a peak oil guy, I'm not a peak copper guy, etc. That stuff is in the ground. We just have to go get it, and that requires investment, and investments require higher prices, and that's how commodity cycles always work. So I think we are starting a new commodity cycle. So the fundamentals are very much there. The momentum, every commodity has different momentum charts. The investor positioning, my one concern is on the precious metals, where the investor positioning in Asia, I think, got quite extreme. And so if you want to make a bearish case, you focus around that. But on the flip side, you could say, yeah, but investor positioning in Europe and America is nowhere near extreme. We still have a long runway for this to go. And then you look at valuations, and here this is where it gets tricky because some of the commodities are actually super cheap. Energy today is super cheap. Food is super cheap. I think a lot of industrial metals are neither cheap nor expensive. A lot of the precious metals are historically expensive. Gold relative to energy prices is high. Gold relative to US wages, gold relative to US house prices. You name it, on any sort of long-term historical measures, precious metals do seem punchy. So putting it all together, you know, as you try to parse this out, I think it makes sense to be long commodities, and today perhaps to cash in some, not all, but some of the gains in precious metals and reallocate into other parts of the commodity complex.
So Louis, in kind of wrapping up here, I'd like to ask you, and you can take the option here. What is something that you believe that either most people around you don't believe, or most people that, let's say, most something that you most disagree with if you go on X, let's say a more mainstream group of people that you disagree with?
Well, the beauty of X is you get positive reinforcement all day, right? You cater to, so I don't think I disagree with anything I get on my X. Everything on my own X is filtered to reinforce all my preconceptions. No, jokes aside, look, I believe that China is essentially where the US was in 2009, 2010. That, in 2009, 2010, everybody was going around saying we were facing a new normal. It was going to be a lost decade. It was going to be low single-digit returns. And the US ended up delivering their 15 best years on record. Now, one of the reasons was that growth in the US was weak, that GDP growth was actually this one. We forget this now because the stock market did so well. But the period 2009 to essentially 2017, 2018, GDP growth in the US was always subpar. And that's why Trump got elected in 2016, because most people were pissed off. And that's why the Fed could do QE1, QE2, QE3. They could keep pushing money in with no fear of inflation, which is always the big constraint to policymaking, to both fiscal deficits and monetary policy, is this fear of inflation. You remove that and you can let loose. This is exactly where China is today. They're going to be running budget deficits of 10% of GDP this year. It's the one country in the world that doesn't have to worry about inflation. And so they're pushing money in. That money that in the past would have gone into stocks, would have gone into, sorry, in the past would have gone into real estate, not stocks. It would have gone into real estate. It would have gone into the economy. It is now going into stocks. So you pick up your Wall Street Journal, and on page one, it tells you, oh, Chinese growth, you know, they're doing all the stimulus, but growth is lackluster, et cetera. And on page two, it tells you, oh, the Hang Seng Index keeps on making new highs. And for me, it's actually the same story. And everybody's like, well, how can this be? Growth is bad. And the stock market keeps on making new highs. And I think most people, and this is to answer your question, this is perhaps the disconnect in most people's minds. Most people think that you need to have super strong growth to have a strong stock market. But the US proved that this isn't the case. And I mean, there's lots of other examples, of course. What you need is you need growth to not absolutely collapse. You need to not be in a recession. But actually, an environment where you have okay, fairly mediocre growth and super strong stimulus can actually lead to massive re-rating of equities. And you saw this in the US, and I think we're witnessing that in China.
Louis, I want to thank you for an excellent and, wide-ranging, hopefully thought-provoking interview. For those that want to read more of Louis's work, he's available on X at Gav Vincent, Gav underscore Vincent, GAVE, and of course at gavkal.com, GAVEKAL.com. Louis, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Great to meet you.